The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
The 9/11 conspiracies, fact or fiction?
We often hear of different fat-burning strategies, but what's fact and what's fiction?
Let's get to the fact versus the fiction here.
John Bailey, literary critic John Bailey, said that the imagination is in love with the feel of fact.
Here's what you do. One, separate fact from fiction.
Here are two books, both on the future. One is positive, one is negative, or vice versa. One is fact, one is fiction, or vice versa. Both are a little funny, a little hopeful, a little scary.
The problem with China is that the more you report on it and try and gather facts, the more you realise that facts are being suppressed. It's a suppression of truth system.
When you're making a fiction film, when I'm making a fiction film, I'm trying to make the artificiality of the situation, the artificiality of the script, feel real as possible. So you're trying to do all those things that give it that authenticity, whatever you call it. And when you're making a documentary, often you're trying to do the very opposite. You're trying to bring some of the storytelling form of fiction into real life.
The view I take is that the fiction I create out of fact becomes the truth.
Is a story not a story because it's true? Is a fiction not a fiction because it's based on fact? In this McLuhanite world of multimedia, it's not only the forms that have become confused in the way they overlap, but the content. Journalism has always suffered. Ever since news was first reported, a major problem has been the eye of the beholder, or opinion dressed up as reportage. In reverse, the clean economic language of fine journalism influenced much literary writing, especially one might think crime novels. Many authors tried to beat the flowriness out of their prose. But at what point does writing become so effective at portraying reality that it no longer seems made up at all? First, let's examine the latest State of the Nation work, Capital, by John Lanchester. He talked to Lindsay Irving.
Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner that I love London so. Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner that I think of her wherever I go.
It was like Texas during the oil rush, except that instead of sticking a hole in the ground to make fossil fuel shoot up from it, all people had to do was sit there and imagine the cash value of their homes rattling upwards so fast they couldn't see the figures go round. Once the parents had gone off to work and the children off to school, you saw fewer people in the street in the daytime, except builders, but the houses had things brought to them all day. As the houses had got more expensive, it was as if they'd come alive and had wishes and needs of their own. Vans from Berry Brothers and Brud brought wine. There were two or three different vans of dog walkers. There were florists, Amazon parcels, personal trainers, cleaners, plumbers, yoga teachers, and all day long, all of them going up to the houses like supplicants and then being swallowed up by them. There was laundry, there was dry cleaning, there were FedEx and UPS, there were dog beds, printer ribbons, garden chairs, vintage film posters, same-day DVD purchases, eBay coups, eBay whims and impulse buys, mail-order bicycles. People came to the houses to beg and to sell things. Towels for the homeless, utility company salesmen. The tradesmen and trainers and craftsmen disappeared into the buildings and came out when they were finished. The houses were now like people, and rich people at that, imperious, with needs of their own that they were not shy about having serviced. There were builders in the street all the time, servicing the houses, doing up lofts and kitchens and knocking through and adding on, and there was always at least one skip parked in the street and at least one set of scaffolding. The new craze was for doing up basements and turning them into rooms, kitchens, playrooms, utility rooms, and the houses going in for this craze had conveyors of dirt flowing into skips. Because the earth was compressed by the weight of the houses above it, as it was dug up, it expanded to 5 or 6 times its original size, so there was something bizarre, even sinister, about this digging, as if the earth was spreading, vomiting, rejecting its own excavation, and far, far too much of it seemed to come out of the ground, as if it were fundamentally unnatural to reach down into the earth to take up more space, and the digging could go on forever. Having a house in Pepys Road was like being in a casino in which you were guaranteed to be a winner. If you already lived there, you were rich. If you wanted to move there, you had to be rich. It was the first time in history this had ever been true. Britain had become a country of winners and losers, and all the people in the street, just by living there, had won. And the young man on the summer morning moved along the road, filming the street full of women.
Lachester, this novel is focused on the fortunes of the residents of one London street at a very particular moment in time, the end of 2007 to the end of 2008. Why did you zero in on that particular moment?
I've always thought that obliviousness is interesting, and partly that's because that the things by which historical periods are judged most severely in retrospect are usually the things to which they're oblivious. They're the things that people didn't, that were right in front of people that they didn't see. And part of the reason I started writing the book towards the end of 2005, early 2006, was I thought I could see a crash coming. I thought it was going to be a housing crash. It was as if what goes up will keep going up forever automatically. You know, there was a general feeling of infinitely, endlessly rising prosperity, and it seemed to be manifestly the case that the bubble was going to pop. And I wanted to catch that moment of just the transition from total obliviousness to people starting to wake up.
Yes, which is a process which is not quite complete yet.
No, far from it, I think. And, you know, it's clear that there's a sort of, the whole country is on a sort of trajectory of opinion and of feeling about, you know, where we got to and how we need to extract ourselves from it.
The novel's called Capital, which is obviously London. But I presume it's not entirely accidental that Capital is also the name of quite a famous book by Karl Marx.
If I had to, you know, discard one sense of the word, I'd probably discard the London sense, not because that's not important, but just because the idea of what, you know, where people's capital resides is a thing that was very much on my mind. And it seemed to me, it still seems to me, that some of what's happened in Britain is a kind of relocation of value towards is purely financial things, and that saying a moral compass is maybe a bit strong, but there are some ways in which we slightly lost our way as a society. No one wants to go back to the 50s, but there were things about Britishness that were to do with kind of restraint and dislike of excess and active dislike of conspicuous consumption and boasting. I think lots of people have those values in their private lives, but it's as if those things have disappeared as public goods, you know, that things that are virtues in themselves.
Yeah, and public
restraint,
culture.
Yeah. You know.
Do you feel that the Marxist picture of the way this kind of world works is still applies?
I'm reading a lot of Marx at the moment because I'm doing a lecture about him in a few weeks' time at the British Museum. Yeah. There's about 85 billion different components to that question. In my bag here, across the room, I'm rereading the Communist Manifesto, and if you go through it and substitute, firstly, Marxism, once that's completely wrong. When you take the bourgeoisie does this and that, it's just flatly not true. And the class he calls the bourgeoisie is often as oppressed as anyone else. The pure division into owners of means of production or workers doesn't quite fit modern reality. It's more fragmented and complicated than that. But if you substitute the word capital and capitalist for bourgeoisie, it's all true. All the predictions about concentration of wealth, you know, growth of urban states, the consequences of technological innovation. The bits of it that map accurately onto Marx's, you know, sense of permanent crisis and, in, you know, all that solid melts into air and the, you know, the impossibility of living under the system, I think a lot of those things seem a lot truer to people than they have at any point in the last, you know, 50-odd years.
And you've addressed some of this subject matter in non-fiction, I mean, with your mesmerising book about the crash, Whoops. I wondered what made you reverse out of economics and back into fiction with this book, which is the first time you've written a novel since Fragrant Harbour, which is quite a while back now.
10 years. It's an optical illusion in a way, because I'd started work on Capital first, and then I finished a draft of it. And partly because I thought a bust was coming, and I thought it was a London property bust, which is still completely wrong, you know, as it turns out. And it was this other crash that happened. And because I was observing it as I was writing the book, in real time, I was very interested by the credit crunch. It struck me as an extraordinary thing to have happened. And I finished the draft of the book and thought, it's probably not the most selling way of describing it, but Whoops is a kind of benign tumour that grew out of Capital.
What better way to pitch it?
And I excised the benign tumour and stuck it in there.
Right. And why did it seem a better way of sort of addressing these things in fiction than in factual writing?
Well, a corny way of putting it, but I don't think it's necessarily wrong, is that in fiction you can try and address things that stay true, you know, things about obliviousness. And the permanent motivating force in financial markets, anyway, is greed and fear. That's always been the case, always will be the case. But the specifics of what happened in the credit crunch were unique and distinctive. There's certain sorts of specific that don't fit very well in fiction. Credit default swaps are not a universal human truth. They're just a really interesting, bizarre, slightly mad thing that blew up the global financial system. And also, so I wanted to quarantine partly just the explanation. You have to explain the credit crunch. And it's very hard to explain. Basically, explanation kills fiction because it's impossible to have the necessary complexity within, you know, within dramatic structures. The readers just fall asleep halfway through when you have characters selling, you know, Nigel, remind me, what exactly is a collateralized debt obligation?
Yeah, difficult to work that in. But the book is a report on the, I don't know, the condition of London, if not state of the nation, that mythical beast. There are kind of obvious obstacles to this kind of project. I mean, one that you imagine, it's harder to just follow your imagination because in some way the characters have to stack up as an ensemble that are a representative of London.
I didn't lean too hard on the idea of being representative. It's a bit like I'm Irish on my mother's side, and I argue with my Irish family about Father Ted, which they see as a sort of satire on Irish society. But I think it departs from Irish society. That's where it begins, it's not, and it kind of leaves from there, goes off into a world of its own. It's a thing that John Bailey said about Pope's poetry, that the reason it's sort of better than satire is the things take on a life of their own. So I did do a certain amount of thinking about, as it were, who ought to be in the book while laying the foundations. I think it's oppressive to feel a responsibility to be representative, because then your characters are like, you know, ambassadors at the UN. And
there's something like allegory in a way.
Exactly, allegory, and there's something lifeless about that. So having sort of done a certain amount of mulling it over, it's partly why it took me a while to write. I spent a lot of time thinking about, because you only get one go really to get the architecture right. Once you've committed past a certain point, you can't, you know, excavate the foundations while you're also trying to do the roof. And so I spent a bit of time thinking about that at the start, and then tried to sort of trust the characters to be sufficiently alive.
The other issue with this kind of novel is whether it's possible to write a novel about the whole of society at all. Some Marxist critics have been saying it's impossible to write the kind of novel that, you know, Tolstoy was able to.
I think it is impossible to write a book that embraces the whole of society, but it might not be impossible to write a book that makes the reader feel as if you are, if you see what I mean. You know, it's what Henry James described as drawing a circle around the relations. All novels have a circle drawn around the relations, and there's always more left out than there is put in. But it's one of the basic things that all works of art do, and works of fiction try to do, is to have what's present shadowed by what's absent, the unsaid pressing on the said. You know, whenever there's a tragedy, people talk about community, and my hackles always slightly rise because you have your teenagers pretending that they knew the victim who was, you know, stabbed at their school. In fact, you know, in a different class, they didn't remember what they looked like. But it's the community responses, and that thing about community is a largely Kant term. I think it's a sort of emptied out word for the reality, which is that it's incredibly fragile and contingent, the way we barely brush past each other.
This is a very different book from your last one, obviously, because that was non-fiction. But all of your books have been very noticeably different from each other. Is that something you work hard at?
No, I can't do it any other way. I find I sort of use the bits of myself that go into a particular book, I sort of use up. I suppose I hope that you gradually learn, you know, you gradually improve, that you learn things each time. And I certainly found, moving between fiction and non-fiction, that the kind of toolkit you acquire in writing fiction is incredibly useful in telling non-fiction stories. And similarly, I think the thing I've learned from writing non-fiction is the thing John Bailey said, literary critic John Bailey, said that the imagination is in love with the feel of fact, which is the thing I thought about a lot, that if it feels like a fact, it makes better stories. I quite like the idea of writing, you know, a sequel to something, but I don't seem able to do it. My publisher, The Debt to Pleasure, used to joke that the second book should be called The Invoice from Pleasure.
London is the place for me. London, this lovely city.
John Lanchester there, a novelist turned journalist turned novelist again, which might be thought to be literature's equivalent of the poacher who doubles as a gamekeeper. We'll be hearing later in the programme from another hybrid writer, Paul Mason, of Newsnight, and now of a novel, Rare Earth. But first, joining me in the studio is Rosalind Porter, who's just set up her own imprint, Union Books. Hi, Rosalind.
Hi, Claire.
And on the line from Glasgow is the novelist and cultural provocateur, Ewan Morrison, whose latest thesis, Tales from the Mall, is an open mixture of fact and fiction. Welcome, Ewan.
Hello there.
Have I described you correctly?
Oh, I think that's more than adequate, yes.
Now, we've heard that John Lanchester didn't intend Capital to be an accurate picture of London today, and he got a lot of the technical bits of our economic situation out of the way in his account of the financial crisis. Whoops. But it's certainly a fairly expository picture of the social makeup of present-day London. Now, as it's only published this week, I'm not expecting either of you to have read the whole of it, but I know you and you've been leafing through it, and you've come up with a choice example to illustrate my thesis, which is very kind of you.
But some of it sort of ties itself in knots a bit with trying to find the limits of exposition and of characterisation. So here's a little bit. This is a little section which lays out who the character Roger is, and he's a banker. That was an important skill, a skill worth £1 million in a good year, you would have thought. But it was not straightforward for Roger to calculate the size of his bonus. His employer, a smallish investment bank, did not make it straightforward, and there were many considerations at work to do with the size of the company's profits overall, the portion of those profits made by his department, which traded in foreign currency markets, the relative performance of his department when compared with its competitors, and a number of other factors, many of them not all at all transparent, and some of them based on subjective judgments of how well he'd performed as a manager. And so it goes on, and at the end of it I kept thinking, I've not actually learned anything about how the merchant banking system worked. And what I do increasingly is I just Google things when I'm reading a book. We are sort of coming to a point now where this is increasingly a behavior that people are involved in, and also one when books try to stuff as much of the real world into them as they do, we almost need even more to be stuffed in just to make sense of it.
Now, Ros, is that fiction or is that fact?
Well, the first thing that I'll say is I am familiar with the Roger section because it was serialised in The New Yorker, so that's quite good. I can speak about it. I think my main point would be that I slightly disagree with Ewan in the sense that I don't feel that a novel has a responsibility to kind of digest external, if you will, or topical facts for us. I think all a novel has to do is be a really great novel. I mean, Lanchester very much takes an archetype, I think, of a character with Roger. And so by using an archetype, I think a lot of information is already conveyed already. In terms of the sort of the exposition of the banking stuff, I think that's actually a very digestible piece of information from Lanchester. And it does make sense to me. And therefore, I think that, that actually works. I didn't feel the need to understand something more complicated about banking in that particular passage.
Now, if I were to play devil's advocate and say, isn't that telling rather than showing? Isn't that a classic problem of fiction writing that he's demonstrating?
I don't think that was overly telling. I think that was a nice balance of sort of showing, whereas something in, you know, a novel like Union Atlantic is very much a stronger example of telling, and it feels a bit didactic.
Union Atlantic is by
Adam Hazlitt.
And tell us a little bit about that.
This is another banking novel, if you will, and it came out, I guess, in 2009, perhaps. It very much, again, relies on archetypes in order to talk about the banking crisis in America. So you have somebody who is the head of the Federal Reserve and is very interested in money, and you have his sister, who is a kind of representative of old money and is a sort of a hippie, and she's trying to prevent an enormous McMansion from being built next to her kind of farm. And it's basically a reaction against new money. And I don't know if you agree, Ewan, but the actual banking stuff in that novel, of which there is a lot, is almost impossible to understand for the layperson. But that didn't affect my reading of it, or in fact my critical judgment of it, because I reviewed it as a novel. I suppose my point is that I'm not sure these kind of topical pieces of information always interfere with the success of a novel.
Well, it's strange to note that, because a lot of the reviews you see for Adam Hazlitt and for Franzen is that people talk about skipping the boring bits. And part
That's
of the,
Jonathan Franzen.
I'm in agreement with you, Roz, in as much as I think that the novel has a specific form, and it's really about the ethical dilemma of a character. As soon as you get into complex descriptions of phenomena in the world, and goodness knows they seem to be getting more and more complex the more we understand about them, for example, economics and trading and derivatives, then really the novel struggles to try to contain that information. I'd rather we had very pared back novels which were about people and ethical behaviour and actually kept all of that stuff slightly outside the novel.
Isn't this a manifesto for your forms of fiction, the sort of fiction you like to write, Ewan?
Well, I only came across this way of doing fiction out of necessity, really, because a lot of people were saying to me when I was writing a book about a shopping mall, well, why don't you turn it into a novel? So I studied all of the novel books. There's one by Victor Hugo, one by Catherine O'Flynn, one by J.G. Ballard. And then I came across David Shields, and he had a wonderful quotation here that said, there's inevitably something terribly contrived about the standard novel. You can always feel the wheels grinding and going on. And I did feel that the more I find out about shopping centres, their history, about retail, about consumer manipulation, that what I had to do was just separate the things out. So I would separate fact sections and fixed sections.
Now, David Shields, we interviewed David Shields on this podcast Reality Hunger, which is the book you're talking about, came out a couple of years ago. And what was interesting was a lot of people were very critical of him as being a blocked novelist who was making a thesis out of his blockage. Mm. What do you say to that?
I think he was blocked because of a problem that was happening within the novel, actually. I think he was just someone with a bit of insight who was saying, hold on, no, why should we have to try to force all of this wonderful stuff that's in the world into the rather limited form of character? And I think you really find it in books like Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, where you've got tons and tons of exposition squeezed into a personality and scenarios created where people will just talk politics to each other.
Now I'm going to bring Roz in, who's been scribbling away madly on her piece of paper.
You know, what you're saying about the Franzen novel, is that just not an aesthetic judgment that you feel about that particular novel and not a kind of claim that topical information doesn't ever work in novels? When you say that character is a limited form with which to convey information, look at a novelist like Dickens, who very much uses topical information in his novels as the driving force, yet they function as sort of aesthetic experiences in their own right as well.
Well, I think that we are getting to a stage where we have the overstuffed novel just now. It's been noted by a few people. Again, McCrum talked about, why are contemporary books so long and getting longer? And I think part of it is the multi-protagonist attempt to depict a street or a world or a social arrangement or whatever. I just feel that novelists are taking on board too much.
Mm. But what about a novel like Wolf Hall? I mean, again, taking historical information, is that an example of a novel that stuffed too much in and failed as a novel?
Well, I couldn't read it personally. There are some novels that are overstuffed and take on too much, which I do enjoy. For example, DeLillo's Underworld, I think, which is probably the thing that set this entire ball rolling. No, I mean, I just love the simple, singular novel, the classic novels, Crime and Punishment, The Outsider, Hunger by Nuthampson, because they don't have to bother telling us about the way the world functions.
I'm going to just change tack slightly. I want to broaden this out a little bit. You wrote a very interesting blog for the Guardian Books website about the collapse of the forms that we've previously held as sacrosanct, not least the distinction between fact and fiction. And you say a score of new books and e-books with mainstream publishers are motivating young readers to find out more by interactively mixing historical fact with first-person fictionalised account and embedded video. Now, it just so happens that we've heard this week that the John Lanchester book is going to be accompanied by an interactive project where readers can interact with the characters. Do you think this is a new step on that along that path?
Yeah, and I think it's a very exciting one as well, because one of the things you find when you're researching a book which is tackling the world is that you've got all this multi-format, multimedia information, whether it be videos or essays you've come across, even images that sort of are part of your research, but it seems a shame not to kind of contain them and put them out in some way as part of the book, because the research in many ways can be even better than the product that you've squeezed into the form of the novel. So I think it's wonderful that people will then have access to all of this material which has been generated in the creation of a book.
You call it multi-screening.
Multi-screening is a horrible neologism, really, but it's kind of representative of the way I believe that we take in information anyway. I took a screenshot when I was writing the article and I had 5 screens open at the same time. Now, of course, one can say that when we're on YouTube and we're checking a video on derivatives, when we're reading something on Kindle and we're checking facts on Wikipedia at the same time, that's a confused way of reading. We're not actually reading properly. But it's something that we are doing increasingly. It's very easy for us sometimes to say, oh, that's just bad and we must return to the way we did things before. But it does seem to me like an inevitable change in our reading patterns.
Ross, do you suffer this change in your reading pattern, or are you more old-fashioned?
Speaking as a publisher for a moment, I mean, this is what we all thought the world was going to look like 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, and it just hasn't turned out that way. I mean, what we call kind of enhanced e-books are sort of trudging along, but at a pace that is much slower than we ever anticipated. And as a publisher, we still very much think of these sort of multi-screened media device thingies as something completely separate from the book. And, you know, take a book like The Hare with Amber Eyes.
It didn't even have any pictures of
it
the Netsuke in them.
It didn't have any pictures. And they've now put out an illustrated edition on the back of the huge success of just the words on the page. I don't think there's anything wrong with extra material, visual material accompanying a text. And I'm not against this kind of multimedia interaction with text, but I don't think that it's ever going to replace the reading experience. And I think our imaginations are just too big and too complex to ever be hindered. I think television and film would have taken over from reading. I think this moment would have happened already.
Can I just take this opportunity to actually introduce Union Books, which is your new imprint? and your first book, which is Moby Duck, and it's from the US originally. It's by Donovan Hone, and it has a subtitle that reads like a journalistic odyssey in itself. The subtitle goes, "The True Story of 28,800 Bath Toys Lost at Sea and of the Beachcombers, Oceanographers, Environmentalists and Fools, including the author who went in search of them." Are they going to be Googling bath toys?
Well, this is so interesting that you bring this up. I mean, I sat there with this book and thought, what category do I put this book in? What is it? Is it a travel book? Well, sort of. Is it a memoir? Sort of. Is it an environmental book? Sort of. And I think we finally decided on travel/memoir. But when it was published 2 weeks ago, the category that it went into on Amazon was bath. So it was number one in bath. I'd never seen bath as a category before.
It's a good way to get a number one, though.
Great way to get a number one, but it has nothing to do with a bath.
That reminds me of the Shirley Williams climbing the bookshelves. It was this fantastic anecdote, her memoir, which was seen to be filed under mountaineering.
Exactly. I mean, going back to your point in the introduction, Claire, where you talked about the confusion of fiction versus nonfiction, and I guess generic categories more generally, I don't see it as a confusion. I think it's the most exciting thing that's happened to nonfiction for a long time. I mean, if you think about what nonfiction used to be, it used to be history, biography, memoir, autobiography. And the fact that I now sit down on a daily basis and look at the books I'm publishing and think, what the heck do I call this? I think is exciting. And it means that, you know, the kinds of nonfiction writing that we're seeing, and again, which is influencing fiction writing or vice versa, I think these interdisciplinary modes of writing make it better. And if sometimes a piece of sort of journalistic writing enters a novel and doesn't work for whatever reason, I think that's probably limited to that particular book and is not a kind of overall problem with the novel more generally.
In your blog, you make the point that a lot of this has been going on for years and years and years, and particularly you quote the great German thinker Walter Benjamin, who wrote in, I think it was the 1930s, about fully developed capitalism and the form of communication that emerges from it.
Yeah, and how storytelling and the novel are increasingly threatened by the growing form of information. I mean, that was the 30s. That was long before he could have even imagined the world that we live in now. Just a little backpedal there. This whole thing about shelves I find really interesting, and shelf space and what actually is designated as fiction and non-fiction, because I've had the same issue with Waterstones at the moment with Tales from the Mall, because they can't decide whether it's fact or fiction. And strangely enough, it's one of these things that comes up when we talk just about the economic structure of the publishing industry and how it was very much based in the last century on shelf space, designated shelf space. So you'd have your top 20s in different sections. You'd have basically a choice of books which is designed to fit a shelving unit.
I sort of think there are books that are good and there are books that are less good and there are books that are more good. I mean, a brilliant comparison with John Lanchester's Capital at the moment, I'd say, would be Craig Taylor's Londoners, which is a nonfiction book about the people who actually live in London, but the real people. It's been described as an oral history. It's neither an oral anything, because it's actually text that's been edited very, very rigorously, and it's not history either, because these people are the people who are living here now. And in some ways, it reads more novelistically, if you will, than Capital, because John Lanchester relies, as I said before, on archetypes. Whereas in Craig Taylor's book, every time you come across a new section with a new person who tells you about who they are and what they're doing in London, all your expectations are completely deflated.
So what is so unusual about your book, Ewan?
Well, it's not a million miles away when I look at it in paperback from the Alain de Botton books, really. He has essays, he has images. I guess what's so odd about the book is it's a mixture of facts and factoids and some oral history, some tales that were told to me by property speculators, mall workers, market researchers, and just by shoppers. And they're intercut with a handful of stories that I wrote myself. And also on the back of that, we got video links for a lot of the stories, because I used to be a director and made little videos to go with it.
Now, how are we going to get hold of this book?
You can pre-order it on a site called cargopublishing.com, and it'll be available as app-enhanced ebook and paperback.
So that seems as good a point as any in which to turn to our final contributor, the Newsnight economics editor Paul Mason, one of whose reasons for turning to that traditional form may be the oldest journalistic conundrum of all, which is being unable to prove what you know while remaining determined to tell the story. Though his latest work, Rare Earth, is written as a novel, it's a thriller about the rush to obtain minerals. Paul read an extract to Lindsay Irving.
I keep hearing about this rare earth, Brough said. What is it? Oh boy, you're in a rare earth hypermarket and you don't know what it is. She stared at him and kicked the sand. This here is the Walmart of rare earth. It's like turning up in Saudi Arabia and saying, like, what is this stuff? Oil. Brough could only think of the medicinal clay called Fuller's Earth. What does it look like? Okay. Chi pulled a glass vial of silver powder out of her combat trousers, which she held up to his gaze. Like Rare Earth 101 would take maybe an hour, which we don't really have time for, but the for dummies version is, this here is neodymium. Feel. She snapped the vial and poured a tiny speck of the powder into Brough's outstretched hand, which began to tingle. It's only mildly toxic, she grinned, and only radioactive for about 70 seconds. It's oxidizing right now. He peered at the crystals, which were turning white and beginning to stick together. Try not to breathe it in, she added. There's 17 rare earth elements. Know what an element is? A light bulb lit dimly in Brough's brain. She continued, scandium, yttrium, and the 15 different lanthanoids. This is one of the lanthanoids, neodymium, ND, number 60, on the periodic table. Last time he'd encountered the periodic table, he'd been throwing darts at it in the common room at university, the other side of an entire adult life lived in fear and ignorance of science, except where it could combat liver failure or sexually transmitted disease. So this is a kind of metal. Found in the Chinese desert, Chi mocked him. And is it precious?
Paul Mason, this is a novel about lots of things, but what it's centred on, as spelt out conveniently in the title, is rare earth. I don't think I'll be alone in sharing your hero Bruff's ignorance of what on earth that is.
Well, rare earth is probably the most strategic mineral on the planet. It is the 17 minerals that you get out of basically the same place that you get iron ore. But what they do, they make the modern techno-economy go around. So they're in hard drives, they're in wind turbines, they're in a Toyota Prius. The crucial element in the Toyota Prius engine is a rare earth element. Now, China owns 95% of the world's supply, and it's also been trying to buy the companies that have the 5% of the rest of it. The rare earth story in the novel is only a fictionalized version of what is clearly going on, which is that the Chinese government has placed a huge limitation on the export of rare earth on environmental grounds. It so happens that the automobile companies that really need rare earth are Japanese, and its critics, China's critics, accuse it of trying to force more and more high-tech production onshore into China by restricting the access of supply to rare earth. But of course, being as how it's produced in the desert, in the what we call the Chinese Wild West, there is, on the record and noted, a huge amount of piracy and contraband in it. That's what I chose as the setting for the story, which is the illegal economy in China.
And it's a complex story, which overlaps with a lot of other aspects of the Chinese story that most of us also know little about. You've reported on it before, but why did it make sense to tell the story as a fiction?
The problem with China is that the more you report on it and try and gather facts, the more you realise that facts are being suppressed, that the people you're speaking to may not even know the full truth, and that the reality is being created around you. And what I mean by that is that we know that there's no free media in China, and we know that the internet is heavily policed. But what does it mean to have 60 years of that? What does it mean to not only know that you don't know what's going on, but probably that you couldn't find out what has gone on, even if you really wanted? It's a suppression of truth system that I thought I'm never going to be able to tell the full story by journalism alone. And so much of it is surreal without even reaching into one's imagination. So much of what happens to you is surreal, both as a Western journalist in China and as a Chinese person trying to cope with the situation. That the leaps into surreality in the book are, they're not massive leaps.
Right, and fiction seems to offer the best way, your best guess at telling the real story.
Yeah, because there was a report from Chatham House not long after I came back, which just basically said large parts of interior China are lawless. They are run by local elites, local hoodlums, rogue bureaucrats. There is very little rule of law. And it all goes alongside one of the most technically rigid and hierarchical systems on earth. And until you can grasp that reality, it's very difficult to tell any story about China, and above all about the people. I've done numerous case studies as a journalist of people, and that's not difficult to tell. But what happens to them, and what happens to them over time, and how do they see their future? So I thought, well, let's try using fiction to tell the essential story of a Wild West that's out of control, full of, you know, repressed, crazy, anxious people who don't really know what their own role is supposed to be sometimes.
So although it's a serious story, I mean, what's resulted in your novel is also a kind of madcap caper.
Well, all journalism is a madcap caper, and it, particularly in environments that are either hostile or, in this case, surreal. And I as a reader, love epic
And I love satire. And I think this is a satirical epic. It would have been easier to satirise China if the audience for it knew more about China. One had to constantly stop oneself from explaining what is going on. I also wanted to satirise the Western media's ill-starred attempts to understand China. There's a TV station in it that decides to do a special edition on the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, but not call it a massacre.
The novel does show a country in a state of complete ideological incoherence, doesn't it? People sort of parrot state communist propaganda, but they're also, at the same time, ruthless entrepreneurial free marketeers.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole generation in China that think they are communists, but they are really neoliberal capitalists. And sometimes when you say this, actual Chinese, you know, young communists will say, do you really think our country is capitalist? And I say, well, look at the offices of, you know, Goldman and Citi and Deutsche. They're bigger here than they are, you know, where they come from. And in the book, there is this whole gang of female bikers who are wrestling with this reality of what are they supposed to be? And as well, they're wrestling with what are they, as women, supposed to be? Because people have said to me, you know, this is a bit far-fetched. These female bikers who end up on Tiananmen Square on the 60th anniversary parade in miniskirts designed by, you know, kind of Gucci and Prada white leather. And this is true. This is real. I didn't fictionalize it. There is a female militia in miniskirts. I'm sorry. And how are you then supposed to theorize the Communist Party's official understanding of what women's role in China is? I find it a very exploitative society as far as women are concerned.
That's another aspect of the novel which will maybe shock readers expecting something from the voice of Newsnight Economics, which is that there's an awful lot of commercial sex.
There is a lot of sexual exploitation in China. When I was there, the cause célèbre, which had to be whispered in a quasi-radical bookshop meeting I went to, was about the famous incident of the bureaucrat who had hit a woman on the head with a wad of money because she refused to perform a sexual favour for him, and she was a waitress in a restaurant. So she had taken a knife and stabbed him to death.
Your hero is a constitutionally disobedient, drunk TV reporter. What on earth kind of inspired your portrayal of this kind of character?
I wanted to find a way into the China story. And for a whole period, there weren't going to be any Western people in this, and it was going to be a purely Chinese story. And it's a multi-point of view novel, so that while the protagonist is a Western journalist, there are other very powerful protagonists, a Chinese crazy propaganda guy and a cop who's kind of seen it all. And I just thought, well, I'm having trouble explaining and understanding this place to myself, and I have spent quite a bit of time on and off there. What would it be like if one of those, the Frontline Club in London, what would it be like if one of them turned up and tried to do it? What's been very gratifying is that some Chinese writers who've responded to it, most of them have said, no, you've probably got it about right. It is as mad as this, and it is as weird as this to be on the receiving end of a bureaucracy's actions that are never explained to you. And most Chinese fiction is about this. I mean, the themes, I only read Chinese fiction in translation, but so much of it is about this. I mean, it wouldn't be the only book in which a crazy Chinese propaganda guy or a cop who goes undercover to try and sort things out, or hoodlums or prostitutes or people traffickers exist. Chinese literature even now is full of these characters.
'I would dearly love to meet that punk Chinese girl biker gang, the Steel Fuchsias, but I fear I'm going to have to track them down in the pages of Rare Earth, which is published both on Kindle and in Good Old Paper by OR Books and No Exit Press, respectively. Be that as it may, there's a huge amount to look forward to on our website and in our newspapers over the coming week. And with us to run through it all is Mike Bonnet, who's with us on Work Experience. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yes, in The Guardian's Saturday Review, Mark Lawson is looking at the rise of the sequel, with particular reference to Andrew Motion's follow-up to Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island.
Yeah, we interviewed him this week for the podcast, and that'll be going up next week. He was fun, wasn't he?
He was great fun, wasn't he? Yeah. The Observer will be looking at Roddy Doyle's Fighting Words, a new creative writing centre in Dublin, inspired by his friend Dave Eggers' scheme in San Francisco. And if you've missed Jeanette Winterson's audio essay from The Room for London, do have a listen to it. It's a beautiful piece of writing about her 4 days observing London life from a boat on top of the Royal Festival Hall.
And if you haven't caught up with our new Teen Book Club, it's going great guns on the Teen Books website and on Facebook. Our first choice is Ali Kennan's latest novel, Bullet Boys. You can find out more about that on guardian.co.uk/teenbooks. And we've got some copies of the books to give away to people who'd like to join in. But that's it for this week. Thanks to John Lanchester, Paul Mason, Rosalind Porter and Ewan Morrison. From me, Claire Armistead, Mike Bonnet and our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.